Welcome, I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Calls Media Roundtable. More than 100,000 visas have been revoked since Donald Trump's executive order on immigration was signed last Friday, according to government lawyers. We just got that news from CNN. The order bans Syrian refugees from entering the United States indefinitely, bans all other refugees for 120 days, and bans people from Iraq, Syria, Iran, Sudan, Libya, Somalia, and Yemen for 90 days. We also got word this morning that the Trump administration enacted new sanctions on Iran, and we'll talk about coverage of that a little later in the show. We're also going to talk about coverage of Neil Gorsuch, Donald Trump's nominee to the Supreme Court. How are the media reporting on crucial issues affecting affirmative action, LGBT rights, and abortion? And beyond saying that Neil Gorsuch is a competent man, what about his record and what he would actually do on the Supreme Court? Today we are joined by Michael Doyle, reporter with McClatchy Newspaper's D.C. Bureau, where he covers the Supreme Court and federal courts. Hi, Michael. Welcome back to the show.
Good to be with you again.
Great to have you back. Farnaz Fasihi is a senior writer with the Wall Street Journal. Hi, Farnaz. Great to have you back. And Jody Jacobson is editor-in-chief of Rewire, an online publication that provides commentary, analysis, and investigative reporting on reproductive, sexual health, rights, and justice. Hi, Jody.
Hey there, how are you?
Good, thank you so much for joining us. As we always do on the roundtable, we like to start off on a positive note and highlight journalism that stood out this week. So, Mike Doyle, let's start off with you. What did you see this week that got your attention?
The always great David Fahrenthold with the Washington Post, who you probably recall from his coverage of the Trump nonprofit charitable giving deals, had a piece about Steve Bannon, the highly influential political advisor and counselor to the president. And Fahrenthold looked very closely at Bannon's past speeches, his radio shows, his writings, to flesh out the portrait of a man with very distinct views that are very influential on the president.
What stood out for you in this story, Michael? Because I'm noticing now, here we are in February 2017, Steve Bannon is on the cover of Time magazine. Chris Hayes looked at his past on MSNBC last night. I mean, a lot of journalists are finally looking at who Steve Bannon is. So what strikes you about this coverage, and why now? Why not last year?
Well, that's a good question. Not last year, but what I liked about Fahrenthold's work was the thoroughness of it. It appeared to be original primary source research, where it appeared that he himself went pouring through the transcripts and listening to the tape and watched the video and pieced together something he himself did. I haven't seen the Time magazine piece. I assume it was solid work, but there was the thoroughness, the digging to the very bottom of the well, a sense that I got out of what David did.
And also, Jody, why don't you jump in here? Because I wanted to ask you all about Steve Bannon later, but since David brought it up now, let's talk about it. How do you think the media should refer to Steve Bannon? I called him last week a white nationalist who ran the far-right site Breitbart, who's now chief White House strategist. Donald Trump put him on the, quote, principles committee of the National Security Council, which means he's been elevated above the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff and the director of national intelligence. I was kind of struck when I heard NPR simply call him a news executive earlier this week.
Well, I did not hear NPR say that because I've shut NPR off. I just can't take it anymore. I'm not shocked to hear that. I honestly have given up on NPR. If they called him a news executive, that's just one more reason I just can't listen anymore. It raises my blood pressure. The man is a white nationalist and a white supremacist. If you look at his readings, if you look at what he said, if you look at everything he's done, if you look at the videos he's made over the past 6 to 8 years, it's very clear. And, you know, just because someone denies what they are labeled doesn't mean that's not what they are. I'm not really clear how much more he needs to do except for put on a white hood and stand on the steps of the portico of the White House in order to convince people that that is his philosophy, that he believes, as does Richard Spencer, who is, you know, a self-proclaimed white supremacist, in sort of culturally you know, intact areas, as they call it. I think that's kind of a focus grouped way of trying to describe what we're talking about. We have a piece up this morning where I don't think it's been reported before that looks at the fact that Breitbart was working with the Border Patrol union well before Trump was elected to pursue their own notion of who should be banned at the borders. Mm. And the Border Patrol itself has some problems, and Breitbart was right in there, and then they later had Trump come on that show, and they bragged that they were the ones that created, you know, the Muslim ban, that's where it came from. So I don't think there's any question that this man is a white nationalist, and that we shouldn't get away. We shouldn't let anyone get away with making euphemisms out of that.
And we're guilty. We didn't talk about Steve Bannon last year, and we're going to do a show about him on Tuesday. But he is, according to so many reports, writing executive orders, and he's right there with Donald Trump, you know, putting out these executive orders, making these very important decisions. Farnaz, let me ask you, there's so much reporting now about the Steve Bannon's past. How do you think the media should report on Steve Bannon as we move forward?
I think the media needs to stay focused on the facts. I think we have to try to tune out the hype and figure out a way that informs our readers best, sift through any projected, whatever they're calling, post-truth. I think one of the things that I hear, on social media is that the American media has to figure out how to cover the new era of post-truth. And I've pointed out to many of my colleagues that foreign correspondents like myself, who've spent many years covering autocratic regimes, are very familiar with how to cover post-truth and how to try to challenge things that we don't deem factual coming out of an administration. And I think that there has to be sort of a rethinking among reporters in Washington and anyone covering this administration as to that the old rules just don't apply, and you have to have a better strategy and really apply some of the tactics and strategies that we utilize in other countries when we cover governments that we don't necessarily trust.
Well, the piece that Mike Doyle brought up is called Why Even Let Him In? Understanding Bannon's Worldview and the Policies That Follow. It's by Francis Stead Sellers and David Farenthold. And Michael Doyle is a reporter in McClatchy Newspaper's D.C. Bureau. Jody, what did you see this week that caught your attention?
Well, I was thinking about a piece that was in Harper's that it just gave me a chuckle because it was one of their sort of overview pieces. I forget what they call it. It's kind of a rough cut of, you know, what's happened in the past week. And it was written in a sort of snarky, fun way that I think was, you know, it gave me a little bit of a boost, if only because it was the same news but presented differently. And I really appreciate their the front of their magazine where they have these posts regularly.
All right, so a shout out to Harper's Magazine. It's a great magazine, and it's nice when you can take the time to actually read it and not be online. And that's Jody Jacobson, editor-in-chief of Rewire. And what about you, Farnaz? What did you see this week that you thought was done well?
What did I see this week that I thought was done well? I thought the New York Times' story where they looked into how dark view of Islam from the far right is now moving to the center of American politics was very well done and very timely in terms of understanding where this ban comes from and some of the sort of the ideology behind it.
And can you give us a thumbnail sketch for people who haven't read that one?
Yes, let me just hang on a second. I need to pull it up. So it basically talked about some of the views that people close to the Trump administration have expressed about Islam and how it had perhaps informed this decision. That this sort of, you know, in the past administrations, this view that Islam is inherently a violent religion was really on the fringe of politics, and now it seems to be coming more to the center. Basically, that's. That's what it was in the New York Times just a couple of days ago.
And Reuters has a new story out called Trump to Focus Counter-Extremism Program Solely on Islam. The Trump administration wants to revamp and rename a U.S. government program designed to counter all violent ideologies so that it solely focuses on Islamist extremism. This is five people who were briefed on the matter told Reuters about this. This just came out this morning. So it's probably related to that New York story, New York Times story.
Kind of related to the New York story, exactly.
Right.
I think, as you know, sort of some of the immediate news of what this ban means, and we're moving forward. I think reporters are having a chance, if we can, to sort of catch our breath and see how we can dig deeper, immediate headlines and try to make sense of some of these new policies and ideas.
And that is Farnaz Fasihi, senior writer with The Wall Street Journal. And we will put all of these articles on our website at yourcallradio.org. Well, let's dive in now and talk about media coverage of this ban. Again, it's an executive order signed last Friday. It bans Syrian refugees from entering the United States indefinitely, bans all other refugees for 120 days, and bans people from Iraq, Syria, Iran, Sudan, Libya, Somalia, and Yemen for 90 days. I'd like to talk to all of you about the human side of this and then the political side of this. Obviously, they're connected. But first, Farnaz, this has received so much attention. I have been reading so many stories about how people have been affected by this. People who are trying to come to school, are trying to get jobs, have sick family members in the Middle East, and they had surgeries scheduled in the United States, and now they're in limbo. What's really struck you the most about the reporting focusing on the human side of this ban?
I think the most effective way that we can drive a policy home to our readers is to try to put a human side to it, to try to make them see themselves in these people. I'm a child of Iranian immigrants. My family came to the U.S. when I was 10. And on Saturday, when I was watching the news and seeing all these families being detained at various airports, I had a flashback of when we arrived. I was 10, my sister was 5. With my mom at JFK, and we were really anxious. And, my mom kept reassuring us that we were safe and we'd be okay. And my father was left behind in Europe trying to get a visa, and we had a lot of anxieties about what will happen if he can't make it and will our family be separated. And I couldn't really imagine what it must be like for those who had arrived over the weekend and were told that they weren't allowed in. There's been a lot said about how this is un-American, and to me it seems very un-American. This has always been a place where you feel accepted. I put out a call on social media for people, Iranians particularly, because I'm Iranian, to come to me with the stories that they have heard or if they had stories, and I just got floods of emails and calls. I talked to a doctor in Atlanta whose wife is on life support right now. On life support. And they have two little children. And her parents were turned around in Doha and told they can't come to the U.S. to perhaps, say goodbye to their daughter. So there's just really heartbreaking stories coming from all around.
Michael Doyle, what about you? What strikes you about the coverage of the human side of this ban?
Two things. One is just how utterly sympathetic the plaintiffs are in the cases that have been brought. Normally, when you're an attorney, you want to find a plaintiff who has a good, compelling story to tell. And when you're a reporter, you look for the same. And in the lawsuits filed by the American Civil Liberties Union and others, they invariably found incredibly sympathetic stories. Mr. Darwish, who filed suit in Brooklyn Federal Court, was an electrical engineer from Iraq who had translated for the U.S. Army and had endured considerable threats and dangers. And he was exactly the sort of human interest story that attorneys and reporters alike look for. The second thing I'd just bring attention to is the how emergencies spur media responses. The University of Michigan Law School, in response to the lawsuits, set up a clearinghouse. It's clearinghouse.net, and it tracks in real time what are currently 14 different lawsuits challenging the order.
Wow.
And so reporters or lawyers or anybody, just interested people, can go to the site and see the original filings, the government's responses, the judge's orders, and cut out the middleman and the media altogether. So this is a case where, as a response, or there was, in essence, a disintermediating response to bring information directly to the people in an emergency situation.
Hmm. Well, speaking of bringing information directly to the people, Jody, once again, social media has really played an incredible role in telling this story, both when it broke, the protests that took place at the airport where people were doing Facebook Live from the airport, Facebook Live videos, which prompted so many more people to get on BART or a bus and go to the airport. I mean, it was just amazing to watch it in real time.
Yes, we had one of our folks went out there immediately to JFK and did a live stream from there that got literally well over a million views and was picked up by German television. I think it can't be understated the importance of social media in this moment, partly because, you know, think about this. So many of the people who were being held in detention were literally in a domestic black site. Mm. Nobody could get to them. Nobody could see them. They weren't even allowed to see lawyers. Some of their family members did not know. You had 80-year-old mothers who were ill, who were coming to see their kids for the first time in 5 years. You had an 18-month-old, a 5-year-old. So you had these different people who are really, I mean, so out of the realm of anybody that should be, you know, targeted for anything, who had been cleared to come here, who were refugees or immigrants or green card holders held incommunicado by the Border Patrol. And if not for social media, I think so much of what happened would never have happened, because in real time, people were able to see injustice being, carried out. And I think that is really profoundly important. It's also profoundly important for pushing back on the outright lies that this administration is telling.
And what about, you know, what's interesting is to look at the countries that got the most attention, and I was noticing that Somalia really didn't get that much attention, so I did a search, and USA Today had a piece about how 15,000 Somalis have fled their war-torn country to Kenya and then plan to resettle in the United States, and now they're stuck in the world's largest refugee camp because Trump suspended the asylum program. So what's amazing about this, Farnaz, is there's so many stories here. I mean, if you search Sudan and Trump, I mean, there's just so many stories. Somalia wasn't getting the headlines, so I wanted to find it, and it's out there. You just have to look for that one.
I think that's the case. I think that the volume of news coming out of Washington this past week has been tremendous. And, you know, media only has so much space or so much staff, so you have to kind of prioritize and see what you can do.
Right.
Like you said, I think that we just can't do everything at the same rate. We have to just kind of manage the news as it comes in. I think this is a story that is not going to go away. I think that even though we don't have people arriving at airports right now being detained, so it doesn't have the dramatic effect that it had over the weekend, there are many people who are being banned from boarding flights to the U.S., right? So they're stuck in destination. So I think we have to shift, we have to kind of broaden our perspective and try to look at this from every direction. And I think this is a story that will continue to, its effects will continue to ripple and provide material for us to investigate and write about.
Farnaz, can you stay with us for another 5 minutes?
Sure.
Okay, that is Farnaz Fasihi. She's a senior writer with the Wall Street Journal. Michael Doyle is a reporter in the McClatchy Newspaper's D.C. Bureau, and Jody Jacobson is editor-in-chief of Rewire. And if you have any questions or comments about coverage of this ban, what refugees have been going through, the human side of this, and then also the political side, we're going to talk about that in a minute. We'd love to hear from you, 866-798-8255, 866-798-8255. And let's hear from Ruby in Mill Valley. Hi, Ruby. Welcome to the show.
Hi, good morning. Thank you so much. I'm a numbers person, so I'm wondering how difficult it is for journalists to get actual statistics on of the number of people who have been refused entry. How many are there for medical, coming here for medical reasons? How many are returning home? How many are students? How many are family members visiting? We've been so deluded by the president, DDT's spokesperson, saying only 1% of the 350,000, which is like, you know, he said like 100-some people, whatever the number was, are being detained. It makes it sound so insignificant. But is it really difficult? I just wonder how difficult it would be to get the statistics from the people.
Yeah,
besides the anecdotal stuff, which is heartwarming.
No, that's
heartrending.
That's a great story, Michael Doyle. What about getting your hands on those statistics?
It's extremely difficult, and I agree completely with the caller. The anecdotal stories are compelling and heartrending, but they are simply that anecdote. Oftentimes, you need to wait for court proceedings to get a solid number. Just today, in a federal courthouse in Alexandria, Virginia, an attorney for the government revealed for the first time that over 100,000 visas have been revoked as a result of the president's order. That's a number, that's a good solid number, but we didn't get it until there was a court proceeding. So a lot of times, reporters are dependent upon legal action which in turn compel government officials to reveal documents that they would not otherwise do.
Hmm. Farnaz, how are you dealing with this at the Wall Street Journal and trying to get this crucial information?
I think, like Michael said, it's very difficult to get actual numbers. There's been, from the Iranian community side, there's an Iranian-American Lawyers Bar Association. They've been logging cases on an Excel sheet that they've provided to reporters. And I think it's somewhere in the 400s now. But these are only people who hear that they're collecting numbers and call in with their stories. So they write the name, the reason why they were traveling, what the circumstances were. But I don't think that kind of solid statistics is something that we can get our hands on. It's mostly just reaching out to various community organizers to see if they have any numbers.
Hmm. Well, we should... go ahead, Jody.
No, I was going to say, I also think that numbers are important, but they also can be misleading. And the reason I want to say that is, you know, the White House tried to play this down with, quote, only 109 people were affected. Well, really, each individual person has basic human rights. And many of these people have gone through years and years of, you know, tracking and interviews and visa requests and all sorts of stuff to finally have a dream realized. And they've suffered through that process to get here. So while I think the numbers writ large, the fact that we now found out that 100,000 people have had their visas revoked, which I find absolutely disgusting, on the other side, each and every one of those people we need to treat as a basic human being. And I feel like sometimes that gets lost when we don't put the two together and look at them really from the vantage point of, you know, what are we really saying about ourselves as a country when we might put someone through, you know, someone in a refugee camp through years and years of waiting, some of these people 10 years of waiting, only to turn them back at the moment that they've sold off everything to come here and finally get a home.
Well, exactly. And also, when you're talking about many people who live in these countries, I mean, they have lived under U.S. foreign policy for decades, whether it's bombs, sanctions, support for dictators, and then not supporting dictators. And before we let you go, Farnaz, I just wanted to ask this question about the lack of coverage of U.S. foreign policy and really connecting these dots. I haven't seen much attention about just U.S. foreign policy over the last 20 years. According to Reason Magazine, the list that Donald Trump put out, Iraq, Syria, Iran, Sudan, Libya, Somalia, and Yemen, comes from a 2015 immigration law that designated those countries as, quote, countries of concern, which required additional visa scrutiny. And according to Reason Magazine, of those seven countries, every single one but Iran have been the target of some kind of U.S. military action over the last 20 years.
Correct. And Iran has been a target of U.S. sanctions, not military action, but really crippling economic sanctions that have affected people. So, yes, I mean, in case of Iraq and Libya and elsewhere, I think this ban really presents a policy challenge for the U.S. I mean, in many of these cases, the U.S. is bombing these countries or invading or meddling in their politics from the viewpoint of a moral high ground, saying that we are, in the case of Libya, you know, President Obama said we're going to start bombing because we want to protect the people of Benghazi from you know, a massacre. In case of Syria, they want to make sure that you know, ISIS doesn't take. So there's this idea of we're in getting involved to protect an innocent population. And if you're not willing to give that innocent population that has is being bombed upon any sort of refuge in your country and ban them and say you are not good enough to even come here for a visit or to come and live here, then it's going to be really hard to generate any source of positive public opinion about your military actions or sanctions in those countries. You're inevitably going to create hate. You know, I don't think that hate is something that the U.S. can really afford in the Muslim world.
Michael, what about this important angle about U.S. foreign policy in these countries over the years?
There's always a lack of adequate coverage of foreign affairs, and when we write the stories, often they're not well read. So I'm not going to defend or explain away the fact that I completely agree with that there's inadequate coverage, not just of foreign policy, but more broadly of the context behind any daily emergency. In the media business, we tend to focus on what we see in front of our face. We tend to pay less attention to how it got there.
Right. And as this piece points out, Donald Trump becomes the fifth consecutive U.S. president to preside over military operations in Iraq. And as you said, Farnaz, Iran has not faced U.S. military action, although not for lack of interest by people like John McCain, for example, mm-hmm. who sang Bomb Iran on the campaign trail in 2008. Farnaz, before we let you go, what are you working on right now?
I am working on some stories that have to do with this immigration ban, and I am covering the UN for the journal out of New York and writing about diplomacy, which is a very relevant topic. And you know, from the viewpoint of the United Nations, this administration presents an unprecedented challenge because for the first time they have to convince an American president to stay engaged and not abandon the UN.
And the UN ambassador, Nikki Haley, doesn't have much foreign policy experience at all.
She does not have much foreign policy experience, but, you know, she has certainly a learning curve, but she's here and she appears very engaged with diplomats and it just has to, you know, we have to see what kind of policies and what kind of tone she takes on. On her first day, when she got to the UN, her tone was very defiant and sort of startled at people here. She said that the U.S. was going to start collecting names at the UN of nations that were not supportive of American interests and then punish them accordingly. And that really rubbed diplomats the wrong way. Saying that this isn't the right way to start, a new diplomatic gig.
Well, Farnaz, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for inviting me, Rose, as always. Good to talk to you.
You too. That is Farnaz Fasihi. She's a senior writer with the Wall Street Journal, and you can find her reporting at yourcallradio.org. Coming up after the break, we will talk about media coverage of Donald Trump's Supreme Court pick, Neil Gorsuch, with Michael Doyle, reporter in McClatchy Newspaper's D.C. Bureau, and Jody Jacobson, editor-in-chief of Rewire. This is Your Calls Media Roundtable, and we'll be back after this.
This is Your Call on KALW, a show that relies on engaged listeners. You can join today's conversation by calling 866-798-TALK. That's toll-free 866-798-8255. And you can post a comment or question at yourcallradio.org or tweet us at yourcallradio. Coming up at 11, it's Inflection Point with host Lauren Schiller. Stay with us.
This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. Coming up on Monday, we will rebroadcast a conversation we had with Jane McAlevey, author of No Shortcuts, Organizing for Power in the New Gilded Age. Jane McAlevey argues that meaningful change can only happen with organizing that puts ordinary people at the center of their own struggles. So we'll talk about the most effective strategies as so many people are engaged right now and taking to the streets. Today, it is our media roundtable, and we're joined by Michael Doyle, reporter in McClatchy Newspaper's D.C. Bureau, where he covers the Supreme Court and federal courts. And Jody Jacobson is editor-in-chief of Rewire, an online publication. They're so busy these days because they cover reproductive and sexual health rights and justice issues. Let's change gears now and talk about media coverage of Donald Trump's nominee to the Supreme Court, Neil Gorsuch. There was a really interesting story in the New York Times called Conservative Groups Unify to Push Neil Gorsuch's Confirmation. According to this story, three dozen of the best-financed, most battle-hardened players in the conservative movement have joined forces to promote Gorsuch, including the Koch Network, the National Rifle Association, leading evangelical and anti-abortion groups. The Wall Street Journal had a similar piece about anti-LGBT anti-abortion groups, Christian rights groups celebrating his nomination, people saying this is basically a dream for the Christian right. So, Jody, given that, how should the media introduce Neil Gorsuch to the public beyond talking about how intelligent he is? I heard that so many times, which is pretty obvious if you're going to be nominated to the Supreme Court. But what about his record?
Well, it's a very important question, and I agree with you. The focus is on, you know, he's the conservative Merrick Garland. That's kind of the way that people have posited him. I think his record for, you know, the things that I care about, evidence-based policy, reproductive and sexual health and rights, human justice, all of those things, is abysmal, frankly. He is, for one of the architects of the Hobby Lobby policy, you know, in the lower court level, and he is very apt to expand so-called religious freedom, which we call religious imposition, to corporations, to businesses, over and above the rights, the health, the evidence-based needs of people. So from that vantage point alone, we're really concerned. But of course, there are other issues about, you know, things like his attitude toward corporate regulation and government regulation, which happens to be on the no regulation is a good regulation kind of wavelength. In other words, the government should have less ability to regulate. And we only have to look at what's happened in the past day or so, where the Congress has eliminated a regulation whereby coal producers were disallowed from pouring their tailings and other poisons into streams. That's now been lifted. You know, we're going to see a real assault on human health and environmental health, which is absolutely tied to the economy, but otherwise often separated from the economy. And I think that Gorsuch is the kind of justice that will support that effort.
Michael, you wrote about Neil Gorsuch for McClatchy. Your story is a Colorado native. Neil Gorsuch would bring distinctive Western touch to the Supreme Court. He's 49 years old, very young man. He's a Denver-based appellate judge, and he's dealt with regional disputes from snowmobiles in Yellowstone and motorized vehicles in a Colorado national forest to a magnesium mine cleanup in Utah. You really dove into his record. What does it reveal about Gorsuch and the environment, for example?
Well, at the risk of having you get mad at me, it reveals him to be a very intelligent judge, very thoughtful. He does his homework. He reads carefully. He writes wonderfully. He's got a flair for clarity and directness in writing that is matched maybe by Chief Justice Roberts and from the left, Elena Kagan. He's also, Denise Grab, who's at New York University Law School, very smart researcher, looked very, very deeply into his work, and I relied upon her for my help. And she points out that he brings a Westerner's point of view. He's somebody who loves the outdoors. And he is not always predictable in his positions. For instance, in the Utah magnesium mine case that you made slight reference to. In that case, the U.S. EPA that his mother used to run in the Reagan administration was suing a company called the U.S. Magnesium over toxic cleanup. And Judge Gorsuch sided with the EPA in this case. So I don't think it's accurate to say that he is invariably on the side of big corporation or invariably against the environment. He is a conservative. Environmentalists will probably not like a lot of what he does, but he seems to give very serious thought to everything he writes.
Right, because in your piece you report that the Sierra Club declared that Gorsuch has proven himself hostile to environmental protection. The League of Conservation Voters called him both radical and dangerous. Earth Justice called him extreme and unacceptable.
Right. So there's that very black and white rhetoric that is matched by the equally black and white rhetoric on the other side. And one thing I'm trying to do as a reporter is shed some light and enhance the clarity with which people can see the judge apart from the rhetorical flourishes on both sides.
The New York Times did an analysis, and they put Neil Gorsuch to the right of Justices Samuel Alito and John Roberts. Did you catch that one, Michael?
I did. I think it was based on work by Northwestern Professor Lee Epstein and others. And you always have to pay close attention when Adam Liptak from the New York Times and his cohorts do work. I did see that. I don't know what to make of it. I'm not in a position. It was put together by people smarter than me. I'm not sure I agree with their conclusion, but it's something people should look at.
Yeah, what do you think, Jody?
I think that I really appreciate what Michael is saying. I think that I look at this from a different perspective. I look at it from the perspective that we have a crisis of environment and economy of growing proportions, especially in the area of climate change, but not only there. Look at Flint, for example, now on going on, what is it, 3 years without clean water, and we're on the verge of eliminating any kinds of protections for communities like Flint to have clean water. I look at it from the vantage point of human health, the environment, and the economy, and one or two, you know, upheld arguments does not make me feel safe or better from the vantage point of what is clearly an ideological battle. And there's no question it's an ideological battle, but it's a battle between, some may posit it as a battle between two ideologies. I posit it as a battle between corporate ideology and evidence. And the evidence around the environment is indisputable. There is no dispute that we are, you know, sullying the environment on which humans depend. So anyone that is going to have, you know, a 1 every 100 cases where he sides with the Environmental Protection Agency does not give me a good deal of benefit. I'm not saying every regulation is a great regulation, but I do think that we have this notion now in our society that's built up that if you say the word regulation, there's a knee-jerk reaction to it. And in fact, many of those regulations keep our kids and ourselves safe and healthy. And without them, we're going to see a lot of problems.
Well, and if we talk specifically about his record, going to Earth Justice, they've got links. All of this stuff is factual. Gorsuch is opposed to the Chevron doctrine, which emerged from the landmark Chevron versus NRDC decision in 1984 and held that federal agency experts must have the authority to determine how their regulations should be carried out. Gorsuch also believes judges should get to overrule agency experts when deciding how to enforce regulations. Even the late Supreme Court Justice Antonin Scalia agreed with the Chevron doctrine. So according to Earth Justice, this shows that Gorsuch has a history of wanting to limit federal regulatory power. What about that, Michael Doyle?
It's true that in a closely watched concurring opinion, Judge Gorsuch raised questions about something we're going to be hearing an awful lot about, which is the Chevron doctrine, which was written by Justice John Paul Stevens in a case a generation ago. And Judge Gorsuch's opinion certainly suggests that he would be less likely to defer to administrative experts, but that can cut several different ways. If the determination is that the administration experts acted unreasonably, that could have been either on behalf or against environmental interests. Also, it was an opinion that was sort of could be read as an intellectual thought exercise, had no compelling precedential value, and I'm not sure how many allies you would find for the proposition on the court. But it's definitely an insight into the perspective that he would bring on the court. And I would say to listeners, if you don't plan already, get the popcorn and get ready to watch the Judiciary Committee confirmation hearings, because you'll learn more about the Chevron doctrine there than you can ever imagine.
Well, and this is really important because of Donald Trump's executive order. He mandated that two existing regulations must be eliminated for every new regulation that is issued. And a number of publications like High Country News have looked at what this is going to mean for air, water, and land.
Right, and for the readers who aren't familiar, High Country News is one of the great publications on the environmental and resource type issues, and they would know Judge Gorsuch's work very carefully. The working out of the executive order or the presidential directive on two regulations to disappear for everyone that comes into place seems to me itself to be subject to considerable potential for litigation. I don't know how that's going to work out in practice.
Well, I just subscribed to High Country News. I hope you take a look at it. They do excellent reporting. And what about, let's also talk about his record on women's rights and reproductive rights. In the Hobby Lobby case, Gorsuch agreed with the majority opinion that corporations are persons and should not be required to pay for contraceptive coverage under the Affordable Care Act. Can you talk about coverage of that, Jody?
Yeah, I mean, you know, I think by and large, coverage of these issues in the press has been really dismal. For one thing, when you are working for someone, you are working for some sort of compensation, and if that compensation includes insurance, it's yours to do with what you will. In other words, if you are buying into an insurance plan and you have health needs that need to be covered by that insurance plan, I don't see why a corporate entity would have a say over whether or not you get contraception or something else. And the idea that we are now making corporations into religious entities is a very frightening idea, because we've seen a draft executive order running around the administration that effectively expands that to anyone that wants to declare tomorrow they've suddenly found the light and they are religious. And so they can deny people all sorts of benefits, as well as discriminate against them based on their pregnancy status, based on their sexual orientation, based on needs for maternity or paternity leave. So what I find ironic about this, you know, going back to the note that you, the article you noted earlier, I think it was the New York Times, but there have been plenty, that said that, you know, the list of groups that are supporting Gorsuch is long and full of well-noted billionaire and other interests for conservative causes, or what I would call fundamentalist Christian causes, like the Koch brothers. These groups are there for a reason. They know Gorsuch and his opinions. They know what he's about to deliver on the court. One of those things will be to decimate any social obligation for reproductive and sexual health services. And I hear the argument all the time that, oh, I don't want to pay for your, you know, birth control or whatever. Well, for one thing, you're not. You know, unless you're talking about Title 10 or Title 9, where, you know, Title 10, where you get contraceptive services going to low-income people on a sliding scale, what we're talking about is employee-earned benefits. That's the first thing. For the second thing, the cost of unintended pregnancies or of other things associated with not providing preventive services is many times the social cost of, you know, affordable birth control. So it's irrational economically. It's irrational from a public health standpoint. There's no public health data that supports these decisions. It's irrational from every other viewpoint, unless you are a fundamentalist Christian or a fundamentalist conservative who wants to get rid of women's ability to control their fertility.
The other thing that came up this week with the Gorsuch announcement is obviously abortion. And I heard so many times in the media that this issue is the most divisive issue of our time, that abortion divides the country. And it's not true.
In fact, it's not true.
Pew Research just did a study that found 70% of Americans are in favor of Roe v. Wade abortion rights. So, Jody, I hear this from, you name the outlet, and they say abortion is divided. Coming up, but, we're going to talk about Gorsuch. Why?
You know what? It's a really it's laziness. It's a frame that people have picked up and used for a long time. They don't know what to do for a headline, so they use abortion as a divisive issue. Let me just remind people of one thing, if I can remind you of one thing. Even in the most conservative states, like South Dakota and Mississippi, mm-hmm. when abortion bans were on the ballot for referenda, people overwhelmingly and decisively defeated them because they did not want to deny people access to services they need, whether or not they personally thought, I would never have an abortion, no matter what. And that's a conditional thinking, because if you get in a situation where you need one, data shows that so-called pro-life people are just as apt to have an abortion as so-called pro-choice people. But that being said, in both cases, the legislatures overrode the popular vote in order to pass abortion bans. What that tells you is that these legislatures are bought and paid for by the Koch brothers and the fundamentalist right. And it's just indicative of the broader public opinion, which is, you know, people will say, I'll never have an abortion, but I don't want to determine anybody else's right to have an abortion if they might need one. I can't determine their health care needs. And yet, it is constantly posited as though it was the most divisive issue on the planet.
Michael Doyle, what are your thoughts on that? What explains that?
A lot of times reporters will report on the people with the loudest microphone. And when it comes to the court battle, we hear people on both sides, the pro-life and pro-choice sides, speaking the loudest. And I think that contributes to the sense that we're over-reporting the divisiveness. And the fact of the matter is that for advocates, activists, people who really weigh in on the Supreme Court matter, abortion is the most important issue, which is to say it's not necessarily representative of the public at large, but when senators say they will either vote or oppose a nominee based solely on the abortion issue, that misrepresents or establishes the notion that abortion is a crucial issue before the court, when it's morally significant, but it's a very trivial part in terms of the total caseload. But when you're a reporter and you're doing a story on a fight, you listen to the people who shout the loudest, and often that's on both sides of abortion.
Hmm.
I think that, though, if I could just interject one
sure.
thing, that it's our job as reporters and as the media in a democratic society to really go beyond the loudest voices, because, again, referring back to the group that you mentioned who are pushing for Gorsuch, those people, we've done extensive investigative reporting on this, lots of those groups that are involved in making abortion the single greatest thing since, you know, Big Bang, is that are those groups that are funded by the Koch brothers. And what they're doing is they're using abortion as a wedge issue to distract attention from other key areas of issues, like, let's say, fracking in Oklahoma and the earthquakes that they're causing. So we really have to see a broader political movement of distraction as well as substance.
And we have just a couple minutes here, but I wanted to also ask you both, Michael, Donald Trump said during the campaign that he was consulting with the Federalist Society to pick his Supreme Court nominee, and Neil Gorsuch is a Federalist Society member, saying he's a Federalist Society loyalist. Why isn't there more media coverage of the relationship between Gorsuch and the Federalist Society?
Well, there's nothing nefarious about it, and I think there's been plenty of coverage. In fact, every mainstream story I've seen talk about how Leonard Leo from the Federalist Society and the Heritage Foundation were cited by Trump publicly as key advisors for him. And Trump, you can go on C-SPAN and catch Judge Gorsuch, I believe, on C-SPAN doing Federalist Society events. So they're a public, respectable, mainstream right-wing group of well-educated lawyers, and there's nothing being hidden that I can tell.
Jody, what are your thoughts? What about how that connection will affect how he rules on the Supreme Court?
Yeah, again, it's about the ideology. You know, we talk about these justices as though they are sort of, you know, born out of the universe from nowhere, and they come with this jurisprudence, and it's clean and clear, and it's not influenced by ideology, just in the same way that we say, you know, incorrectly that journalists are totally objective. Well, nobody's ever totally objective. And it's better to admit that, you know, you're either looking at evidence or you're forming an opinion, but you are, you know, either ignoring some other evidence or you're not taking into account another opinion. So this man has clear ties to, you know, the Federalist Society and other groups that have extremely specific views on things, and they're unlikely to change. So, again, I use the phrase that people use frequently around Donald Trump. When someone tells you who they are, believe them. And we know who Gorsuch is.
Jody, what are you working on right now?
Well, right now we're in the midst of planning our next 6 to 12 months coverage. So we're going to be doing a lot of state enterprise reporting around what's happening at the state level as policies roll out, for example, around what happens with the ACA and what happens with women's access to care and so forth. We're going to try to do a lot of enterprise reporting there. We are focusing a great deal more on The Hill and hoping to hire another reporter there if we can raise the money, because we've got some fantastic people. We just don't have enough capacity. And we're also developing partnerships with local and state level outlets so that we can help spread some more news to those news deserts that are out there and growing. We're trying to really work in partnership with areas that are not receiving news. We've also got the potential of covering Appalachia as a region, pending a grant. So we're hoping for that.
Wow, fantastic. What about you, Michael? What are you working on right now?
I'm finishing up a story this afternoon about the vacancies in the Trump administration and the significance it has for governance. I mean, we talked earlier about the executive order. One of the problems that people have had, well, the executive order was inadequately vetted, in part because there weren't people on the ground to do it. And the implementation has been troubled. Efforts to mitigate the harm have been hindered as well, just by the fact that until Wednesday there was no Secretary of State. So we're taking a deeper look at the vacancies and what they mean.
Michael Doyle is a reporter in McClatchy Newspaper's D.C. Bureau, and Jody Jacobson is the editor-in-chief of Rewire, and you can find their reporting at yourcallradio.org. Michael and Jody, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you so much.
Thank you. Have a good weekend. Coming up on Monday, we will rebroadcast a conversation we had recently with Jane McAlevey, author of No Shortcuts, Organizing for Power in the New Gilded Age. Labor union members make up only 11% of the workforce. Jane argues that meaningful change can only happen with organizing that puts ordinary people at the center of their own struggle. And then on Tuesday, we're going to do a show about Steve Bannon. We're going to look at who he is, how much power he has in the Trump White House. And on Wednesday, we'll have a conversation with Steve Early, author of Refinery Town, looking at politics in Richmond. KALW is the producer of Your Call. Malihe Razazan produced today's show. Helena Murphy is our researcher. Phil Hartman is our chief engineer. And David LaTulipe is our studio engineer. If you have any show ideas or feedback for us, you can email feedback@yourcallradio.org. I'm Rose Aguilar. Thank you for joining us.